So our first speaker this afternoon is Chris Schuler at University of Minnesota Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences, and he is going to speak today about deep subsurface life in Sudan formation groundwaters. Welcome, Chris.
All right. Hello, everybody. I'm Chris Schuler, a PhD student at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. And I'm going to be talking to you today about deep life in the crust in northern Minnesota, sort of talking a little bit about the groundwater chemistry that guides us to the sites that we want to research in, and then also a little bit about the geochemical changes that are driven by life and sort of impacting the habitability of the subsurface. Before I get started talking about my research, I want to briefly acknowledge everybody who makes the work possible, including my advisors, Kara Santelli and Brandy Toner, the sort of first round of researchers who worked at Sudan before I even got started, and were collecting data there long before I got there, some of which I'll talk about today. And then we have like a broad interdisciplinary team, including a lot of other grad students, as well as PIs. And I'm really lucky to be part of such like an interdisciplinary active project. So I just want to acknowledge them before I move forward. And with that said, I want to now take a step back and sort of talk more generally about the deep biosphere, which is sort of what my project is broadly interested in. The deep biosphere is sort of a catch-all term used to refer to life in the Earth's crust. And that can be things like marine sediments or fractured rock networks in crustal hard rock environments. But generally speaking, I think the best way to define the deep biosphere is sort of hydrologically. So these are sites where you don't have regular surface recharge from the surface. And what that means is these sites not only don't get sunlight, which means that there's no photosynthesis, but they also don't have photosynthetically derived carbon, because anything that's useful has been used up sort of long before water makes its way down to where these microbes actually live. And additionally, any oxygen that's useful has also been used up before getting down there. So in other words, a lot of the sort of high energy metabolic pathways that make life in the surface possible are impossible in the subsurface. And so that makes these distinct, almost alien environments that are super interesting to study because of how different they are from our own. So my research really focuses on the continental subsurface as opposed to marine sediment. They're accessed in very similar ways. You know, you have to drill into the crust, but because it's a hard rock environment, that means that that drilling is very abrasive. And so talk a little bit more about what that means now. So life in the continental subsurface is accessed a lot of times the way we do through mines. So there's commercial drilling, excavating that allows us to use those commercial boreholes then for scientific research. And we think that a lot of life exists like on the surfaces of rocks down there. So you can have planktonic cells that are free floating in the water. The waters tend to be very like not dense, although there's a lot of water, there aren't many cells in it. But over large distances, that adds up to a lot of life still. And then additionally, you'd have these life-rich biofilms on rock surfaces. But because of the drilling required, that's sort of expected but not necessarily proven. Biofilms are fragile, and drilling requires pumping in things like water and mud that can contaminate things or just simply tear up or like cook any sort of biofilms. So research into the subsurface is like difficult to pin down for that reason. And it takes a lot of things like geochemical signals to like suggest what's going on, more so than being able to directly access some of the life that we're interested in. I said before that life in these environments involves different metabolic pathways than we get on the surface, because there's tends to be no oxygen and there's no sunlight for photosynthesis. Instead, you have to shuttle electrons from things like iron or sulfur to other minerals. And so interactions between microbes in the rock directly or between microbes and substrates that come from rock-water interactions are required. And you can sort of think of the microbial life down there as like eating and breathing minerals, because that's the way that they get their energy. And so understanding the hydrology and the geochemistry is as essential to understanding these environments as understanding the life forms directly. And why do we want to care about these subsurface sites? that are like so distinct and separate from the surface. Well, these subsurface environments have been proposed for waste storage sites, for example, for carbon dioxide sequestered from the atmosphere, or for toxic heavy metals like nuclear waste. And when we think about storing stuff in the subsurface, of course, there isn't short-term connections between the surface and these sites, but there could be longer-term connections. And so understanding the sort of chemical changes that microbes in the environment might cause helps us understand the sort of timescales that stuff we put in the subsurface will be stable for. And an example of something that microbes can impact very easily is the stability of something like uranium. Uranium has several redox states, one of which is quite soluble in water and one of which is not. And so understanding the redox transformations that microbes might make in the subsurface lets us know how stable uranium would be if we bury it in one of these deep fractured rock networks. Additionally, the deep crust is of interest as an astrobiological analog. So for example, the surfaces of many worlds, whether in our solar system or beyond, we know they're uninhabitable. They have no atmosphere, nothing to block UV rays, and so essentially life would be totally cooked off of the surface. But under the crust, they're shielded from like the UV, and in places where there's like water flowing through the crust, the environment might look a lot the same as the environment in our subsurface. And so understanding what life looks like in our subsurface might tell us the sort of geochemical traces that would represent life on worlds beyond our own. Additionally, these sites can be seen as an analog for the early Earth, before the atmosphere was oxygenated, when metabolisms of bacteria that existed back then might look a lot like the life that we see down there now. So there are a lot of reasons to be interested in the subsurface. And because of that, research has been done in a lot of areas across the world. So this is a map showing where major papers have been published on in like deep subsurface sites, not including the ocean, but in sort of continental research. It's not exhaustive, but this is where a lot of the major work has been done. And your eyes should see that there are sort of two major regions that have a dense amount of research sites, and that's the South African Craton and the Fennoscandian Shield. And part of the reason those two sites have gotten an outsized amount of research is because they have some of the oldest continental crust that's still remaining on Earth. And in regions with old crust, you have the potential for even longer timescales where water in that crust has been isolated. Meaning you have especially distinctive water chemistries, potentially, because of the long time scales for rock-water interaction, and also microbial communities that have had a long time to evolve without surface interests. But one area that's missing a lot of this interest that has incredibly old crust is the Canadian Shield, which has the oldest crust in North America. And since I made this map, there have been a couple of papers published looking at the Canadian Shield, but it still has received much less interest than the sort of Fennoscandian Shield or the South African Craton, despite containing equally old crust. So I'll be talking about research at Sudan, Minnesota today that sort of starts to fill in this gap in research that's missing on Canadian Shield deep life. So I'll talk a little bit about my field site now, the Sudan Underground Mine State Park. The Sudan mine was an active mine beginning in the late 19th century, I believe, up until the mid-1960s. It accesses Archean crust, so a banded iron formation that was deposited more than 3 billion years ago, and metamorphic alteration finished about 2.7 billion years ago. So this is old crust, and it has had a lot of time to potentially accumulate long isolated groundwaters. The site was of interest for mining because it accesses a hematitic banded iron formation, as well as some massive hematite ore bodies. And so excavation began and sort of concluded in the mid-1960s when they realized that further excavation wasn't necessarily economically feasible. But when they sort of got to the lowest level, they were continuing to drill and look for other places that they might be able to mine. And so we can use those deepest boreholes on the lower level to sort of probe these crustal environments and look at what life might look like. So the major questions I'm going to be talking about today, looking here, relate to the idea of how geochemistry can help us better understand microbial life in these groundwaters in the subsurface. I'll be going through sort of two examples. First, looking at how water chemistry can guide our site selection in the subsurface and sort of help us better understand where to focus our research efforts. And second, looking at how the microbes in the subsurface like interact with the minerals surrounding them and looking at the ways they change this chemistry of these waters and their environment. So beginning with water chemistry and sort of how the chemistry of these groundwaters relates to our research focus within them. So I said before that we're working at the Sudan mine on the lowest level. This level is 700 meters below the surface, and it contains a number of boreholes stretching hundreds of meters further into the crust. There's an array of these boreholes drilled both horizontally and at a downward angle. And we sampled a lot of them looking at the water chemistry and found that it wasn't uniform. So I'll talk a little bit about that chemistry now. First, I want to orient you with a little bit of the geology of the mine and sort of how it's overlaid. I'm going to be talking about both the east and the west drift here. And so the east drift on this side contains mostly horizontal, although some downward angled boreholes. And the west drift contains a lot of both horizontal and downward angled boreholes. And we found distinct differences in water chemistry between the two. And so the sort of physical features of these sites don't matter as much, but I'm going to be talking about both. So I wanted to sort of show the map. And just so you can think about the rock here, the areas in orange have banded iron formation. The sort of green and gray areas have schist. And the red areas are the hematitic ore bodies. So those are the major forms of rock that we see there and that sort of influence the character of the groundwater. So when we looked at these boreholes, we found that they all carried the sort of major ionic character of the water was a sort of calcium as far as the cations go, although there were major sodium concentrations as well, but the primary concentration was calcium. And as far as anions, pretty much all of the salinity was derived from chloride. So these are calcium chloride waters ranging from relatively low in concentration for some of the horizontal boreholes to 2 to 3 times the concentration of seawater in terms of overall salinity for the most saline ones. I'm showing the difference here between the east drift boreholes, which are generally less saline, and you can see with red lines, and the west drift boreholes shown in blue, which tend to have the most saline waters. And again, the solid lines indicate the sort of downward angled boreholes, whereas the horizontal ones are those drilled at a horizontal angle. And so you can see that being in the west drift and drilled at a downward angle, we found the most saline groundwaters. And so where we're looking for the water determines like the salinity that we see in the mine. There are differences across areas of the crust that we explore, but for each individual borehole, things tend to be relatively stable. And in addition to looking at the chemistry of these waters in terms of like the cations and anions dissolved in them, we also looked at the water isotopes. And the reason why we did that is because looking at the isotopes of the water can tell us how long that fluid has been isolated in the subsurface. So while precipitation generally has a sort of standard ratio of deuterium heavy hydrogen to 18 oxygen heavy oxygen, and precipitation in an area will fall along a local meteoric regression. And this shown here is for Ely, Minnesota, right by the Sudan mine. After long periods of time in silicate aquifers at low temperature, water tends to be enriched in heavy hydrogen relative to heavy oxygen. So it moves upward off this line. And so by looking for water samples that plot above the meteoric water regression, we can find the boreholes containing water that's been isolated from the surface for a long time or that don't have a meteoric character any longer. And so we can see again that these west drift boreholes drilled at a downward angle have this non-meteoric character, indicating long-term isolation in the subsurface. Whereas when we look at boreholes drilled in the east drift and those drilled at a downward angle, or at a horizontal angle, I'm sorry, they tend to still have a lot of surface character. So we're seeing a lot of meteoric water in those, whereas these here, these samples here, are accessing these deep groundwaters that don't have the same amount of surface input. Additionally, sampling these waters and looking at the chemistry of all the boreholes we sampled, we can see that salinity seems to be derived from a single source. And we understand this by looking at the ratio of chloride, which we're standing in for overall salinity because it's the only anion we see, to specific cations like calcium, sodium, magnesium. And looking at all of these, we can see that the salinity scales very linearly with each of these ions, telling us that the sort of mixing that we're seeing is one saline source with the same character mixing with low salinity meteoric water. And so we're not seeing any change in the ratio of these cations to overall salinity. And although I'm only showing calcium here, the plot looks identical for sodium and magnesium with regard to how much we're getting linear scaling with our anion and our cation. So we're seeing one source of brine in the subsurface mixing with meteoric water and giving us the salinity profile that we see overall. The red dashed line here, to give you an idea of the overall salinity of these different boreholes, is the chloride concentration in the ocean. And so again, our deepest brines are 2 to 3 times as salty as ocean water. Additionally, we can see plotting deuterium excess, which is a measure of how enriched these waters are in heavy hydrogen relative to heavy oxygen, that this sort of deuterium enrichment, which tells us how long the waters have been in the subsurface, scales fairly linearly with overall salinity. Again, telling us that these brines that we see in the subsurface, the most concentrated waters, are also the most isolated. So again, we're seeing these waters that are saline also have the most sort of character of these deep isolated groundwaters that we're most interested in. And when looking at values like this, values above 5 indicate long-term isolation in the subsurface generally, on the scale of tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years. And so all of the most saline boreholes in Sudan that we're looking at over here pretty much all have this long-term isolated character. So now I want to take Sudan as a site that we've been studying specifically and compare it to other sites where the Canadian Shield fluid chemistry has been looked at. And although there hasn't been a lot of microbiological research done on the Canadian Shield, there has been a lot of research over the past 40 or so years into the chemistry of the subsurface groundwaters and the brines that are found therein. So I'm going to be showing a number of different sites that I'm plotting on a map here. The Canadian Shield generally stretches across this area. And so we're looking at a pretty good survey all across the shield at different mine sites where they've looked at groundwater chemistry. And so again, looking at the overall salinity shown using chloride with calcium concentrations, we can see that all of these sites plot with a general linear salinity. So the character of these groundwaters is fairly consistent across the different sites. The Sudan fluids are representative of all these other shield fluids, and so Sudan is well poised to provide insight into what the deep biosphere looks like all across the shield. It has these representative groundwaters that we would expect to find in deep environments across the Canadian Shield. But Sudan is maybe of special interest because although it's characteristic of these deep waters, the rocks are fairly unique. The banded iron formation provides a unique look at rock-powered life because it has these iron and sulfur minerals that allow for microbial respiration. And so now I want to compare Sudan not just to the Canadian Shield sites, but to a number of deep sites that have been of interest for studying crustal life. So I'm showing different points now, looking at other Canadian Shield sites where there has been deep biosphere research, those are in gray, but also some at the Fenniskandian Shield in Sweden and Finland, which is like, you know, other deep crust, another shield site, as well as the South African platform, which has also been studied because of its deep isolated fluids. And I'm comparing these to another site in the United States, the Homestake Mine, which is now called SURF, which is another deep crustal life site, but with much younger waters and much younger crust. And so we can compare those fluids to those from like these sort of deeper environments and see lower overall salinity, and it doesn't have the same shield brine character because we're seeing a much different like salinity profile. It's not plotting linearly. Additionally, we can see that the Canadian Shield contains uniquely saline groundwaters when compared to these other deep crustal environments. And because of that, it may contain uniquely groundwaters with a uniquely long residence time as well. A mine in Ontario was sort of dated by looking at noble gases in the water and found to have a residence time estimated above 1 billion years. And so the Canadian Shield may have the most isolated groundwaters that we can study on Earth, and so it's of great interest for that reason. Because these long isolated waters can have the most long isolated microbial communities, and so we'll have the most unique ecology for that reason. And yet they're understudied relative to Scandinavia and South Africa. Additionally, Sudan has a uniquely high magnesium concentration relative to overall salinity when we look at all of these sites. And magnesium, along with all these other cations, is derived from rock-water interactions. And so looking at the profile of these cations tells us something about the character of the site overall. And so because we have this uniquely high magnesium concentration, it tells us that we're probably looking at a relatively unique site in terms of the rocks that it accesses as well, for example, the banded iron formation. And so looking at these groundwater chemistries as a sort of proxy for the overall geochemistry of the site can be a useful tool in thinking about the ecology of these sites overall. So to sort of summarize the insights from the water chemistry, some of the boreholes in Sudan access these highly saline groundwaters, but not all do. Despite that, though, we see the influence of these groundwaters in all the boreholes sampled in Sudan, but they're diluted to some degree or another with meteoric water. Additionally, Sudan is representative of broader Canadian Shield groundwaters when we look at its water chemistry, but it has unique aspects, mainly high magnesium and iron, probably resulting from the banded iron formation. And finally, the Canadian Shield overall, including Sudan, has the potential to host some of the most isolated waters that we can find on Earth, and because of that, may have some of the most isolated and uniquely interesting microbial communities. So with that, I'll move on to another segment talking about how the microbes in the subsurface have changed the chemistry of their environment and how they relate to the mineral environment around them. So at the beginning of the talk, I mentioned that there is an assumption made that a lot of the life in the subsurface lives on biofilms on the surfaces of rocks, but that it's very hard to find actual physical evidence of this because drilling into the rocks to access the microbial communities necessarily contaminates or destroys these biofilms. So fundamental questions still remain about these environments: how much of this life really resides in biofilms, and how does that life differ from the planktonic life that's easier to study by sampling water? And you have some examples of the water sampling that we've done at this site already. And at Sudan, we found a way to get at this question. And we put down a camera into the borehole to look at the fracture networks in the rock. And we found these sediments that pretty much immediately blocked the camera and prevented us from seeing much at all. So we were able to sample these sediments with Tremi pipe, and we found that they were these fine black particles that were magnetic. And so we decided to look a little closer and see if these sediments could tell us a bit about what was going on there. So I'll move a little closely through this for the sake of time, but one of the ways that we did that was through X-ray absorption spectroscopy. And we can do that by using specific energies of X-rays below and above what's called the edge of an element. And so at a lower energy, these X-rays will not interact with an element, but above they will. And so we can measure the difference in transmission below, where they go through easily, and above, where they interact with the element of interest and are absorbed, and use the difference between those two energies to create a map of where we see elements that we're interested in our sample. And when we looked at these sediments, we found much more carbon than expected. And we saw these cell-like objects, as well as this tufted biofilm-like objects, which we weren't really expecting at all. We were anticipating that the sediments would be some iron sulfide, and we knew we would see iron. But the presence of all this carbon was very exciting because it meant we might be getting at these microbial communities that we've been interested in for so long. And so looking across the particles, we saw that they were composed of iron like we thought, but we also saw that carbon was ubiquitous in all of the samples that we took, spread between these mat and cell-like forms. But it's one thing to observe this carbon, but that doesn't necessarily tell us that it is what it looks like morphologically. And so we can take a number of these X-ray images at the microscope that we used, moving all the way through this area of interest, and generate a chemical fingerprint for each pixel across what's called the X-ray absorption spectrum. And each form of carbon has a unique fingerprint as we look at all of these images, and so we can see whether those fingerprints represent the material we'd expect to find in cells or in biofilms and compare those. And when we did that and we compared our cell-like forms to our biofilm-like forms, we found the cells had a protein-like signal, which you expect to see from all the proteins found in the membranes and walls on the outside of cells. And we saw that the biofilms had a cluster more resembling lipids or saccharides, which you would expect to find in biofilm-like materials. So this carbon spectroscopy confirmed to us that not only are we seeing life in these sediments, they're forming these biofilms that we expect to see in the subsurface, but hadn't been able to observe to this point. Additionally, we looked at the iron in the particles and found that it did indeed represent iron sulfides, like we expected, although the films themselves absorbed a lot of ferric or oxidized iron as well. So the environment that the cells were in was a little bit chemically distinct from the sediment themselves with regard to iron as well. Finally, we used X-ray diffraction to truly identify the sediment, and we found that it was macanite, or a poorly crystalline iron sulfide. And this is a mineral that commonly forms in reducing environments, usually sediments, through the microbial reduction of iron and sulfate. And this forms ferrous iron as well as sulfide, and when those concentrations get high enough, macanite crashes out. And so this is a process that could be broadly occurring across the subsurface in a lot of these reducing environments, and especially across shield environments like Sudan. And so the implication of this microbial growth that we observe is that we have both a cell and biofilm-like carbon in these Sudan sediments, and that carbon is ubiquitous in the sediments, but not evenly distributed. So some samples had more than others. But these sediments overall are a promising way to really get at the biofilm-hosted life making up the majority of the subsurface and better understand the sort of changing chemistry across the shield. All right, so overall, that's all I've got for today. Thank you very much.
Hey, I'm wondering what kind of water temperature you're dealing with coming out of the deep brines.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the water temperature overall is fluctuating between around 9 degrees and 13 degrees Celsius. So we see that change depending on the time of year. But we're measuring it at the surface, so it may also be influenced by how active the mine is at a time and whether they're pumping in heated air or not. But generally in the area of 12 C. They have been, although the water is very, very saline, so you kind of have to take the measurements with a grain of salt, but they're always negative. And I think the average measurement over time was around negative 150.
This is a wild shot. With such a poor energy situation down there, is there any chance that just like surface tensions could provide an energy source?
That's a really interesting idea. I haven't heard about anything like that happening, but
neither have I.
Yeah, certainly be something interesting to look into.
I'm curious, did you do any PCR testing to try to look at the genetic makeup of some of the biological matter in the sediments?
Yeah, definitely. So that's something we're working on evaluating right now. There have been groups looking more at the like actual microbial communities that are down there, which hasn't been what my project focused on. And there was a paper published, I think, a year ago at this point, looking at the overall communities in the groundwater. But I'm hoping soon to compare those to the communities in the sediments, which we've sequenced but not finished looking at yet, and see how different the sediment microbes are from the overall communities.
Do you have any idea what the ratio of biomass within the deep biosphere would be compared to all the other biomass on Earth?
Yeah, that's a great question. So overall, just in the continental biosphere, there have been a wide range of estimates, but the sort of most recent published estimate was around 20% of overall prokaryotic mass on Earth. And I think that's on the order of like petatons or something like that. So it's quite a lot.